The following is an excerpt from the Science Magazine podcast. To hear the whole show, visit www.sciencemag.org and click on Science Podcast.
Now, David Graham, Science's online news editor, with a wrap-up of some of the latest science news from our online daily news site, Science Now, including a story about carnivorous plants that eat bat dung. That doesn't sound like a definition of carnivorous to me, Dave.
That's a really good point, Rob. You know, when we think of carnivorous plants, we think of plants like the Venus flytrap. This plant, it belongs to a different category. It's called the Raffles pitcher plant, and it's called the pitcher plant because it actually has these centimeters deep pitchers that come out of it that insects get trapped in these pitchers. They are attracted by bright colors and this really strong floral aroma, ultraviolet decorations. They fly towards the pitcher, they get stuck inside, and then they basically fall down into this digestive fluid at the bottom of the pitcher. The plant digests the insects and soaks up nutrients. And in this case, the Raffles pitcher plant has evolved this adaptation because the soil that it grows in is actually pretty nutrient poor, so it has to get its nutrients from other sources, in this case, insects. But what researchers found in this study is that although most of these Raffles pitcher plants make a good living eating insects, there are a few that are actually very bad at catching insects. About 20 or 30 years ago, a researcher who was studying these plants noticed that some of them had about 7 times fewer insects inside than others did. And he said, you know, these guys seem like they're really bad at catching insects. And when he looked closer at them, he noticed that these ones that were bad at catching insects also had a very narrow pitchers, and they lacked the scent and the flashy pattern seen in the other Raffles pitcher plants. But he didn't really give it too much more thought. He said, well, I guess there's just some of these plants that are not as well adapted as other ones to catch insects.
So what prompted the further study to look for another cause?
Well, it was really serendipity or happenstance. A couple of decades later, another researcher was looking at these same plants and he saw bats nesting inside of these pitchers. And he especially saw a lot of bats in the pitcher plants that the previous researcher had described as not being very good at catching insects. For some reason, bats had an affinity for these plants. They were sleeping inside these plants, and these plants were still doing pretty well, considering the fact that they were carnivores that weren't very good at being carnivores. So after that, this researcher and his team did some pretty intensive field work. They spent 7 weeks on daily pitcher patrols, looking at these plants, cataloging them, trying to figure out how many of them had bats in them. Sometimes he found bats sleeping with other bats in the pitchers. And he also attached mini radio transmitters to these bats. And he followed these bats around using the radio transmitters. And he found that they were really only sleeping in these Raffles pitcher plants that were not very good at catching insects.
So bats, while they were sleeping, are...
Well, Rob, they're basically using the plants as both a hotel and a restroom. The researchers found that the plants were actually feeding on the excrement of the bats, and the bats were probably going to the bathroom while they were sleeping or sometime during their stay in the plant pitchers. What the researchers did to find that out conclusively was they actually looked at the leaves that were right adjacent to these pitchers, and they found that these leaves have about 13% more nitrogen, which is a really essential nutrient for plants, than leaves that were farther away from these pitchers that the bats were nesting in. And what's more, the type of nitrogen was a type of nitrogen that's frequently found in carnivores. So that, along with the observations, really cinched for them this idea that these pitcher plants are living off of bat dung.
And it sounds like this has been going on for some time, if the pitcher plants seem to have evolved these different characteristics to be suitable for the bats.
Exactly.
Okay. So mystery solved. What other stories do you have for us this week?
Well, Rob, I have another mystery for you. This one is a medical mystery, and it has to do with the famous Polish composer Frederick Chopin. Now, Chopin died in 1849, and the cause of his death was the subject of a lot of scientific articles. That was a medical mystery in itself. Scientists had originally believed that he died of tuberculosis, or he was originally reported to have died of tuberculosis, but scientists sort of studying his case posthumously concluded that he probably fell victim to cystic fibrosis or liver disease. But there was something else going on with Chopin that was very interesting during his life. He was the victim of frequent hallucinations. He used to describe demons crawling out of his piano, and he also told friends often that he was surrounded by phantoms and that he could see the walking dead. These things that at the time people sort of passed off as, well, this guy's this really brilliant composer, and these composers, these artists tend to be very eccentric, and it was just sort of written off at that. But in this new study, a team of researchers takes a more detailed look at these accounts from the time, and they conclude that actually Chopin was probably suffering from a condition known as temporal lobe epilepsy.
Now, this is not at all associated then with the cause of his death.
Right. This has nothing to do with why he died. It's more about how he lived. And this is sort of an explanation for why he reported seeing all these bizarre hallucinations.
So it wasn't alcohol or drugs or
right. He
like
wasn't
that.
Reported as somebody who abused drugs or alcohol. So there had to be some other explanation. And there are different types of hallucinations. There can be auditory hallucinations, and hallucinations can be accompanied by problems such as vision problems and migraines. But Chopin didn't have any of that. He didn't have the auditory hallucinations. He didn't have eye problems or migraines, at least according to eyewitness accounts at the time. His hallucinations were purely visual. And if a patient were to come into a doctor's office today with those types of hallucinations, and absent all the other factors, a doctor would conclude probably that the patient had this temporal lobe epilepsy, which is how the researchers in this new study reached their diagnosis.
So obviously not completely conclusive then.
Well, not all experts are on board yet. Obviously, we can't talk to Chopin now and figure out exactly what's going on with him. We're really relying on these eyewitness accounts. But the authors of the study point out that even today, when doctors try to diagnose these types of neurological conditions, they often rely on eyewitness accounts too. So they're saying they're not at as much of a disadvantage as you would think studying somebody who died over 150 years ago.
Okay. So last story, what's this last one about?
Well, Rob, sticking on the subject of neurology, this last story is about the science of self-control and how self-control or lack of it in childhood can have dramatic consequences for what we're like as adults.
What kind of consequences are we talking about here?
We're talking about everything from being in debt to having high blood pressure and sexually transmitted diseases, even being in jail. There's really a wide range of links this new study makes to an absence of self-control in childhood.
And positive things are associated then with people who have high levels of willpower, self-control?
Well, yeah, Rob. Actually, previous studies had shown that 4-year-old children who could resist nibbling Oreo cookies, so a hallmark of self-control, went on to do better in school. They scored higher in standardized tests. A lot of this stuff is fairly obvious. You would think if you have good self-control, then you're going to stay away from things that are dangerous, and you're probably going to live perhaps a less risky lifestyle. And these studies had been done before. What's different about this new study is it's a lot bigger than these studies that have been done before. Usually they only dealt with a handful of children. In this new study, the researchers tracked 1,000 children from New Zealand, as well as 500 fraternal twins from Britain, trying to really tease out a lot of these confounding factors like socioeconomic status and IQ, things like that, really trying to get to the heart of this issue of self-control. Does self-control in childhood predict behaviors later in life? And they found very much the same results that these earlier studies have found, that these children that had good self-control in childhood and went on to do relatively well compared to the children that didn't show good self-control. A lot of these children, by the time they were in their 30s, they were earning 20% less than the other children were as adults. They had more health problems like high blood pressure, weight problems, lung disease, and they were more likely to be dependent on tobacco, alcohol, or even harder drugs than a lot of these other adults who had shown more self-control as children.
So can anything be done then for parents out there who may think, oh, I've got a rather undisciplined child. I don't want this child to grow up and suffer all of these things. What can I do?
Well, the real big drawback of the study is it's just a correlation. It doesn't show causation. So the best the researchers can do is say children that don't have a lot of willpower seem to grow up to be adults that get into trouble either law-wise or health-wise, but they can't actually show that not having willpower is actually the cause of this. But one of the outside experts says that he is going to take a more active role in his kids' lifestyles. He has a 7-year-old and a 10-year-old, and he makes them play a game of waiting before they unwrap their candy for no other reason than just to teach them a bit of self-control. And he says it works. They do get more self-control, but it remains to be seen what they're going to be like as adults.
Okay. Well, thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Rob.
So what other stories are you looking into for the site?
Well, Rob, for Science Now, we've got a story about the most distant object ever seen. And this is a galaxy that's 13.2 billion light years away. And also, researchers have just fully sequenced the orangutan genome, and it contains a number of surprises and a number of clues that also shed light on human and chimpanzee evolution. And for Science Insider, Science's policy blog, we've got an analysis of President Obama's State of the Union address, which happened earlier this week, what the implications of what he said are for science and science funding over the next few years. So be sure to check out all of these stories on the site.
David Grimm is the online news editor of Science. You can check out the latest science news, plus all the stories on the science policy blog, Science Insider, at news.sciencemag.org.